Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. I love that you're here with me again, and I know I say this pretty much every episode. I've got a corker today, an absolute corker. Before we get into it, I want to give a shout out to my lovely Patreons. As ever, thank you for your support in helping keep this season going. I can't believe we are getting close to the end of season two already. Can you believe it? I really wanted to have a conversation with another activist for you today, and particularly a white activist, so that you can hear some of the challenges which are shared and some of the nuances of how we are treated and the expectations that are bestowed upon us in our work in the world. Or in our very being in the world. And I am delighted to be joined by campaigner and writer Gina Martin. And if that name is new to you, Gina Martin successfully campaigned to make the act of upskirting illegal in England and Wales. And since then, I think up to four countries have followed suit in campaigning. And that law change happened in April 2019, and it's what she's become renowned for, really. She did a TED Talk, which came out in 2020, and I will leave details of that talk in the show notes, and I invite you to go over and have a look. But I work, as ever, with anyone who kind of enters into becoming an activist or a campaigner of human rights in some form, is that you've experienced some kind of othering or discrimination, and it just becomes untenable for you. And Gina's story is an interesting one, and we dive into it and more, and we talk about everything from how she is placed as an influencer rather than an organizer or a grassroots activist, which is really interesting. We talk about sexual assault and power. We talk about the importance of recognizing patterns of behavior earlier rather than waiting for things to get bad before we intervene. We really talk about the power of the collective in terms of about how we can all use our self-agency to impact change. We talk about how white folk are held to a lower standard. We talk about anti-blackness, and we talk about how you can become intentional with your advocacy and the importance of the often silent but powerful majority. So we go in and more. It's a pleasure to hear more about Gina's world, both within and outside of her campaign work. And I really hope this inspires you to recognize the role that you play and the power that you have and the influence that you have as an individual human being in this world with value to make change in the world around you just by having more knowledge and avenues to be able to transform the helplessness, the anger, the not knowing what to do into something intentional and meaningful. And hopefully by the end of this podcast, you will understand more about what you can do and the important and incredible role that you have in creating change in this world. I can't wait for you to hear it. As ever, I'd love to know what you think. I'm always lurking over on Instagram at Nova Reed Official. So let me know there. And in the meantime, let us go over to the episode. Gina Martin, campaigner and writer, incredible human. Thank you so much for joining me today. Welcome to Conversations with Nova Reed.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. I've listened to so much of this podcast. I'm so excited to be here.
Ooh, then you know what's in store.
Yeah.
Tell me first, Gina, how are you feeling?
I'm great. I'm really good. I'm in a moment of my life where I've been taken away from my anxieties because I have a bigger thing going on in my life, which is that I've just got a puppy.
Oh.
And that's been literally 6 years of my life, I've been desperate for this to happen. And I've been really responsible when it happens and how I find her. And the process was colossal. And now I'm just in the process of learning how to be patient with something that is relying on me. And that's quite an interesting growth period.
Welcome to being a parent for a fur baby. Congratulations.
It's a lot, isn't it?
I have a cat and she's a lot. So, and I'm told that dogs are harder. So yeah, welcome.
Thank you. It's exciting.
Fabulous. So, Gina Martin, who are you beyond your roles?
Wow. That's an interesting question because I've tussled with that for the last 2 years or maybe more, maybe the last 4 years. I think I've seen myself become my work, and it's been really bad for me because I've lost myself outside of my work, because this work isn't a job, like it's a belief system and it's a way of living, and it's a development of myself as an adult, as a person through life. It's like a journey in myself, so I've really struggled to separate those two things. And it's interesting, like, to be asked that now, because I've just been in therapy for 3.5 months. I'm about 3.5 months in, and I'm starting to try and answer that myself now. And I think outside of my work, it's really difficult because I immediately go to just use labels. Like, yeah. I immediately go to say I'm a working class, you know, partner and daughter and sister. But irrespective of other people, I'm a creative.
Lovely.
I'm an artist. I always was when I was a kid. I'm an ideas person. I just really care about ideas and big abstract thoughts. And I love people so much. And so I think I would probably say, yeah, creative and an artist and a people person, hopefully a nice human. But, you know, it's incredible how you get mixed up with the work and it is your identity.
It is and it isn't. And I love that answer. It's honest and it's beautiful. And I think that there's something I've written down here that you there is a danger of losing yourself outside of your work, that losing that part of yourself. So we're starting deep. So let's go in. How are you finding ways to reconnect with who you are?
I'm removing myself from environments where people tell me who I am.
Nice.
I've been in environments for 4 years where people tell me who I am, and I found it incredibly hard to, or it was a lot of pressure to live up to the things they said I was.
Yeah.
After a piece of work that was very visible and very in the public eye, I was told by, you know, journalists, friends that I hadn't spoke to in 10 years, ex-boyfriends, family members, extended family members, the public, all these things that I was. Some of them were positive and some of them were negative, but all of them felt like almost, the amount of the opinions was almost dehumanizing in a way, because it was like, well, I don't know who I am anymore then. Am I this? Is this what you think I am? So does that mean I am that? And so now I'm trying to remove myself from spaces where people tell me what I am and exist in spaces where I am my, like, the most myself. Before this work, what was I like as a kid? Why was I like this? I loved art. I loved drumming. I loved, you know, the comforting things in life, putting myself in those spaces. And then also in terms of developing myself and my beliefs and my work, doing that slowly, allowing myself time to do that in my own time. And that's kind of what I'm focusing on now.
It's important. Thank you for sharing that, Gina. I appreciate it.
Of course. That's why I'm here.
Okay, look, play along with me. I don't edit. Just say what comes up first. When did you realise, if indeed you did, that you were white?
Not for ages. I was never asked to. I was never implored to think about it. I was the default, really. That wasn't a question. I was never described by my race or anything. So it was never, I never really explored it. I think it was probably in my mid-20s when I started reading like feminist books, and when I read other people's stories and stuff, it was like, oh, okay. Because I realized my whiteness. Do you know?
Go on.
Being a white person and realizing my whiteness and realizing those were two separate things and how all encompassing my whiteness was and what it meant. That's when I started to realize I was white, probably in my early 20s. And that's like I wonder how many of us like still don't, you know? It's almost a shameful thing to say. It was my mid-20s when I started to like theoretically articulate the idea that I was white and what that meant and what my whiteness meant. But before that, I was never encouraged to.
Yeah. So you never had to think about it.
Yeah.
It was assumed.
Yeah.
So what does your whiteness mean?
What does my whiteness mean? It's interesting because I think when I'm asked that question, I go to what whiteness means generally. Like the history of it, I go to like what I associate with it. But my personal whiteness has become almost about admitting shortcomings, about separating what I thought that meant from what it actually means, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Trying to figure out what my whiteness does, how it makes me act, how it makes me think, interpersonally, but also just in the world, my observations, my assumptions about things because of my whiteness. I'm trying to interrogate how that makes me move through the world.
Mm.
And that's like a constant thing. Mm. It's like all the time. And there's so much catching up to do because I never had before. I never thought about it before.
Yeah. So what does it mean? And this is you. And again, if you're not comfortable, we don't need to do it. I'm just flowing.
Yeah.
What does it mean for you with the knowledge that you have now and the interrogating that you've been doing now? What does it mean for you to be white?
It means, I feel like it means taking.
Mm.
I feel like it means expecting. I feel like it means... What's the word when you assume you can have something or you don't question? I feel like it just don't like the word because I think it's been diluted, but it just means privilege. It just means options. It just means choices. It just means I have a better set of choices. I don't have to think about things as much.
Yeah.
And it's realizing that and like trying to almost unpick that and realize when it's happening, almost when I realize I have a better set of choices, when I realize I don't have to think about it, being able to like cognitively realize you don't have to think about something is an odd challenge. And that's what the beginning of this realizing about my whiteness was like, it was almost realizing a lack of something, a lack of struggle, a lack of this, and a lack is harder to see, right?
Because it's invisible, right?
Yeah. And so being able to see that, like insulation, it's almost insulation, it feels like a bit.
Mm.
I'm insulated from a lot of things and I don't see them. And so I have to like seek them out and go, okay, I see that now. I see that I'm not experiencing that or that's not coming my way.
Yeah.
But that's existing. It's another reality. It's right there. It's real. It's living. But I'm not experiencing that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I'm seeking out a lot of stuff, I guess, that I'm insulated from. And that's what the last 4 years has kind of been, I guess.
Okay. Thank you. So tell me more about where you grew up and what was that like and what were some of the seeds that were being sown when you were younger that have led you to doing the campaigning that you do now?
God, I love, do you know what? This is so nice to be in a conversation where I'm just like chatting and it's not like, so you're the upskirting girl. And I'm like, no. And it's so nice to answer these questions. It's just like interesting. My childhood was a really brilliant childhood, like a comforting childhood. My family, I'm incredibly close to. My mum and dad have been together since they were teenagers and they love each other like best mates.
Lovely.
And so I was brought up in a very northern, working class, arms around, cuddly, talk about everything household.
Mm.
My mum and dad's relationship, really respectful, really equal. There wasn't really mom or dad problems. I remember getting my first bra and like coming home to my dad and being like, look at my bra. And the curtains were open. He was like, shut the curtains, but show me your bra. That's so exciting. Like, it was so like, there was a lot of those really rigid home roles, gendered home roles were lessened in my family. I didn't notice them as much as maybe I would have in another family.
Mm.
I was also really supported to talk about everything. everything I felt, more importantly. So not just practical stuff, but how do you feel about that? That's okay. Nice. You can cry for hours and we can sit for hours and talk about it. Even if you repeat yourself for 2 hours, it doesn't matter. That's the point, is to just feel and offload and talk and discuss.
Yeah.
And so I think me and my big sister, Stevie, I think we learned quite early how to excavate our feelings a bit.
Nice.
To recognize that we're doing something. Why am I doing that? Why am I feeling that? Where's that come from? That was taught to us by our parents just because of the communication. There was also, it was very working class upbringing. Like my dad's a session drummer and he's been a drummer since he was like 9. And I think the perception of that is that it's really glamorous. Obviously it's an amazing creative job, but it was also like, my dad spent his entire life worrying where the next paycheck comes from.
Yeah.
He's a freelance drummer, and it's rare that you make a life as a musician.
Yeah.
A session musician. He's not in a band. He works for lots of different people. So he was always very worried about, being freelance and providing for the family and stuff. And he was brilliant. My mum went to uni at 40.
Wow.
She had to leave education because she was unwell. And so she went back at 40 and she got a degree, and she used to take us sometimes in with her because my dad was away, and so she had to take us in with her. So we would sit there and I would watch my mom learning and developing herself irrespective of my dad.
Yes.
And my dad support that.
Yeah.
And I was around adults a lot on my dad's job. I was in different countries with my dad watching him. I was, watching my mom until 4 a.m. building maquettes because of her degree and like educating herself and being so excited. And it was just this creative environment where there was no restrictions. It was like classic conversations about marriage. Mom and dad would be like, get married, don't get married, go to Las Vegas, get hitched, we don't care, as long as you're happy. Conversations about uni were like, uni's not the be-all and end-all. If you want to go to uni, that's great, but you don't have to. You
can do what you want. Nice.
You can be what you want. And that was really wonderful because I had this sense of creativity, of choices and options. But as working class people, they also had this understanding and realism about the world too.
Yes.
Which was helpful to have both. I also remember a couple of formative memories of, we were in a very small town. We lived in a very small town and people's mindsets were as small. We'd go to Liverpool in the car to see my family because my family's all Scousers. And they'd be like, you're going to Liverpool? That's so far away. You go to Liverpool twice a week, it's 45-minute drive. It was that kind of place. And I remember some friends or some girls from the class came around. I think it was my sister's year. Some girls from this class came around and one of the girls was like 11, I think, and she made a really racist joke about the food because my mum and dad used to make lots of different types of food because of my dad traveling and she used the P word when we were having Indian food. And I remember my mom being so disgusted and afterwards saying she's never coming back to our house again. So these kind of conversations about deeper than just be kind to people, deeper than just respect people. Those kind of conversations came up when I came my period. My dad was like, let's go to the shop. Let's go to the store and buy pads. It's so exciting. When I would feel upset on my period, my mum would say, it doesn't matter why you feel it. It's coming from somewhere. It's still valid. All these little drips and drabs of conversations were there. And so it developed in me this idea that it broke down traditional structures a little bit for a young mind, I guess, whether that was gender, whether that was, we don't say these things in this household, that's not okay. And so I think as I grew up, I was comfortable to explore those topics or just explore those ideas just because when I was a kid, I'd heard them before.
Yes.
Conversations about power my dad had with me. Nice. So I was really lucky to have that upbringing. And that makes sense as to why I do what I do now, I think, because I explore ideas now and I learn and I try and put good out into the world based on those explorations.
I love that. Oh, wow. Thank you for answering that for me. And I really want to meet your parents.
They're great. They're so much fun.
I really want to meet your parents. And I think that's it. Because a lot of the times what happens with, particularly with my work with anti-racism, is suddenly I'm giving information that is new for people. I mostly work with people who are racialized as white. And it's new for them. And then there is a sense of, embarrassment or shame about not knowing sooner, and embarrassment or shame around what values and what they've been taught growing up. Well, we used to see that, say that, and now I realize it's really harmful, and I've said this and I've caused harm and I'm still using racist language. And then there's this sense of shame around upbringing and the parenting that they've had. And I'm like, this isn't about bashing parents or minimizing what parents thought and taught you at the time that they thought was right. It's like, okay, you've got this set of values that you were raised with. Now, as an adult, we have the opportunity to interrogate those values and see what works for us and what doesn't. And actually, where there's an educational piece that might actually help parents, family, friends along the way. So that the basis of what you're saying around it's you had these ideas, you refer to them as ideas that you had from your parents, and now you're exploring those ideas. And I think that's a really great place to be.
And it takes the conversations about maybe gender, even though they weren't phrased that way, but the conversations about, you know, things in my life as a young girl, like periods, or I remember my dad saying to me once, like, we were talking about sexual assault. I think I must have been a teenager, and he said, like, rape isn't about sex, it's about power. It's not sex. Sex is something that is pleasurable and fun and you love. And I remember that just sticking in my head. And it's like, those conversations are just the groundwork for then as an adult for me to go, right, what does that mean? And and it's so funny because as I do the work, I remember more things.
Nice.
It's really lovely.
Yeah. It's funny, actually. Yeah, that resonates as well. The more you lean into, I mean, part of, I've just written a book so that there are more memories and things that are more raw, because they come to surface for you to try and help, you know, put forward your ideas or help people understand a point by using personal experience. And I've had my dad on my podcast before, but he's a martial artist.
Yes, it's amazing.
You've got several black belts. But I remember when I was growing up, and there was these conversations around, you know, protecting yourself as a woman and also a black woman. And my dad would teach me all these martial art moves. Wow. And actually, they were to get me out of if a man was on top of me. They were to, so I knew what to do. I knew how to manipulate body weight to get somebody off of me. And that's what he was protecting me from.
Wow.
Or at least trying to kick me out with. So what a role fathers have, eh, when they've got girls.
Huge, absolutely huge. And I think I underestimated that until I was in my 20s, and I, you know, my parents were my parents. And then as I got to like my 20s, I was like, wow, my parents are fucking cool people.
Oh, they're human beings.
Not just in proximity to me. Like, it's, you know, they're just, I have a lot of respect for them, for how they raised us. And you know, like, every parent is just a human being doing their best. But like, parents that interrupt cycles, I feel like, the way they talk and the conversations they allow the household to have and the way they role model, I think are incredible.
Yeah. And my parents and my dad spoke about this when we interviewed. They took an intentional stance to teach us in the opposite way to what they were parented, because that, you know, there were things that didn't work for them as a result of that. And so they wanted to make a conscious choice. So yeah, we forget our parents are humans and they're trying to figure it all out as well.
Totally.
So this leads me into, so clearly some seeds were sown. You were exploring ideas, you were figuring out who you were and how you want to interact in the world. And as with most of us who do any kind of campaigning or activism, something has happened, and then we either decide to tolerate it or we do something about it. Mm-hmm. So for listeners who don't know about more of what led you to campaigning towards making upskirting illegal, can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so when I talk about why I did that, or why I reacted to being upskirted like that, which is kind of what that was, I think about a lot of experiences when I was just small, sometimes bigger than others, but just consistent experiences through my life from being a child, that I didn't react to or do anything about, that I lay in bed and thought about, or that festered and I didn't face, or things like, I remember a man saying on the phone to me when I was like literally six, he was talking to me like I was a kid, like he like, oh, you know, normal, like how you talk to a child. And then he like turned and said, I bet you'll look really sexy at your school dance. I was six.
Wow.
I remember like when I was old enough to, you know, just about walk on my own in the village kind of thing that we live in, a little town, there's an underpass not long from me on a main road. And I remember thinking, it's more safe for me to cross the road in oncoming traffic than it is to walk under the underpass.
Yep.
That's the risk assessment of like, there may be men in that tunnel and I'm 14. I'd rather walk in a busy road because that's probably safe. Like that's where my brain was because of the things I'd seen, heard that had happened that people told me about. I remember working in a bar in Leeds in uni and the doormen, it was a really, like kind of affordable bar and there was a lot of students and then it was a part of town where there was quite a lot of violence. And I remember the doorman were wearing stab-proof vests and they came up to me and they said, are you wearing a vest? And I said, no. And he lifted my shirt up and like felt my boobs at the bar. This like 50-year-old man. Jeez. Like so many things like this that you just go, God, that's uncomfortable. And that's really feels horrible, but I don't have any power to do anything about that. But by the time it's happened, it's already over. And I don't have the language to explain why that makes me uncomfortable, why above that interpersonal experience that is wrong, why that is structurally happening, where is that coming from? Why is that expectation that he can do that there? Like all of that language wasn't there yet. And when the upskilling thing happened, I'd just been living in Greece for a year, working on the sea with my partner, living on a tiny yacht, 30-foot yacht, three of us for a year. That was amazing. literally like no bathing in the sea.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And it's the sailing industry is very sexist, like every other industry, but it's very overt in the way that sailing is seen as a very manly thing. And it's like, there's a skipper and it's a very white male upper middle class sport. And so the experiences out there were just like hilarious. It was like I would be parking the boat and there'd be men clapping on the
boat.
Like it was like we were in 1940. It was like, oh, you come on. And so I dealt with that for like a year. And then I came back and I went to this festival with my sister and I was so excited to be out and with her because I hadn't seen her for a year. And when we were waiting for the band to come on stage, it was, you know, bright daylight, family festival. A bunch of guys started hitting on me and Stevie and I just was like, no, no, no. And my sister's very different to me. I'm like, everyone's a friend. I'm a bit like a dog. I'm like, hello, what are you doing? Yeah, cool.
Stevie's, because you like people.
Because I love people. Yeah, I do. And Stevie's very like, I'm going to be quite cold and like until I warm to you, then we can talk, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, these guys, I think he said something normal first and I replied to it. And then he started hitting on us. And I said, no, no. It went on for about 45 minutes. And they were all laughing at me and I could feel it. And then I looked around the back of one, because he had his back to me, one of these guys. And I kind of looked around the back of him and he's on his phone. And he had a picture that someone had taken of someone's crotch, really up close of a girl's crotch. And I knew it was me immediately. And I knew he'd sent it to everyone because they were like looking at their phones and like laughing. And I grabbed the phone and held it up and I was like, you've been taking photos of my vagina, what was wrong with you? And he was like, no, I haven't. And we got into a scuffle. I think I slapped him and he was like shaking me. He was massive.
Gosh, Gina.
And I just like looked into the eyes of everyone around me because I was like, if I look in their eyes, they'll have to help me. They can't avert their eyes from me. Like I have to get them to help. And I looked at everyone. I was like, help, help. And this girl grabbed the phone from me and he got in her face. And then she was passing me. She was like, run. And these two guys were like, run. And they like moved. Because I was in the middle of a crowd of 65,000 people. Yeah. So I was like,
yeah.
So I ran through it. I gave the phone to the security guard. They said, do you want to call the police? I was like, yeah. Not with any real like belief that they would come and do anything, but just because, well, that's the system we have, so yeah, right. And they kind of turned up and they just separated us and said like, yeah, we've seen the photo, it shows more than you'd want to show. But because I had the phone, I took the phone to the police, I had the phone, the picture, the guide, like witnesses, everything we ask people to do in every circumstance, got it all. And they said, oh, there's not much we can do, you won't hear much from us. If you'd chosen not to wear knickers, it would be a graphic image, but you did, so it's not, so you can't do anything. And I was like, okay. So then I went home crying and I just was like, I'm not doing this again. Like, I just want to go to like a family festival and stand in a field without someone, someone creating control over my body, someone taking away my autonomy, someone framing me sexually, someone intimidating me into action or behavior, someone like, it's just exhausting. And it was because of all those things growing up where I hadn't done anything. This time I thought, I'll just take it as far as I can take it. I don't know what it means and I don't know what I'll do, but I can't accept it anymore because I'm exhausted by it. And that's kind of where it began.
Yeah. And then the police did, I mean, don't get me started on the relationship with police that's a conversation for another day, but lack of trust in police is something that is rife within Black communities for obvious reasons around systemic racism that exists within it and outside of it. I know how dehumanizing and also rage inducing it can be when you turn and you have the courage to ask for help and you don't receive it. And you're all victim blamed, essentially. Well, it's kind of your fault, Gina, for not wearing, for choosing to wear knickers that day.
The logic adds up, right? Because the whole year after that was like, wear trousers then. So it was like, I wore knickers and that's the problem. Now I should wear trousers. The whole, have we not learned yet that it's not about that?
Yeah, it's not about controlling women's bodies. It's about, you know, what are we teaching boys and men?
Yes. Right?
Come on, let's be honest. So when the police did nothing, what did you do next?
I turned to social media because I kind of figured out, I looked into the law, which I couldn't really read, if I'm honest. Yeah. I'm not academic. And I think that a lot of the resources that we need to understand to know our rights are so intellectualized, so complicated. And it makes you realize, I'm not surprised most of us don't know what the system can do, quote unquote, for us. I'm not surprised that we don't follow the process, whatever that process is or whether it even works, because access to the information is so complex and difficult.
Yeah, unnecessarily so.
Yeah.
Or not.
I mean, it's so intellectualized, and I understand that it's from bright and brilliant minds that are in that industry, and I understand the intellectualization of something because the process of creating these things is so complex and therefore they get very intellectualized. I get that. But regular working people and regular people who don't work in this industry need to know their rights or need to know what they can do, there's got to be a better way to translate it, because none of us can read it.
Exactly. It's got to be accessible for the people who need to advocate for their human rights.
Exactly. And it's not. And then that begs the question, is it not for a reason?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what I've been thinking about for the past 4 years since I did that work. But yeah, so I looked into the law and I found out through, I asked a friend who was a law student and I said, I can't read this. Can you read this and just send me one pager? And she did. And she said, you're right, you found a loophole that this doesn't exist. The language doesn't exist in law. It's not even recognized in law. And so I went to social media and I put a picture up of me and my sister that we'd taken, and the guy who did it to me, and I'm 99% sure it was him, the position of the photo, because of where he was standing, because lots of reasons. He was in the background of this picture, and I put it on Facebook and I said, don't think the law can help me. I don't think the law can help me. I don't think the police can help me, but maybe social media can. Maybe social media can find these guys, because I just want them for once to feel something because of what they've done here. I want them to know that people think this is wrong, that it's not a joke, it's not a prank, which is what everyone used to call it. And then Facebook took my post down because apparently it constituted harassment, me saying these guys.
I'm laughing. Gina, you know why I'm laughing. No. It's not funny, but it's
just, I know. It's so ironic. It's like someone wrote a satire.
Oh my God.
So them taking those photos wasn't, but the me saying that they did was. And then, I mean, and it's so familiar in all different places in this world. It's just, it never ends, those kinds of ironies. And so then I got even angrier. And then I was like, it's almost like a game at that point. It was like, how can I demonstrate to everyone how every single net that's meant to be in place refuses to catch you, that it will not be there for you? this isn't just about me. And this isn't even just about sexual assault. This is about human rights in all forms. All of these structures that are meant to catch you and give you justice, quote unquote, don't. Like, they rarely do in the way that you need them. And so I started a social media campaign after that, because I was working full-time in advertising at this point, and I was selling. I'm a creator from advertising originally by trade. And I was selling, you know, big alcohol brands and doing big campaigns on social media. And I thought, well, if you make people care about whiskey, then maybe I can make people care about this. So I did, you know, paid posts with a petition, and I interviewed people who had been upskirted, all different people, different genders, talked to them, told their stories. I started getting messages from kids, like 7-year-old children, who their teacher was upskirting them in school.
Yeah.
But because it wasn't technically a graphic image of a child, because they had underwear on, he wasn't arrested. He was just sent to his £500,000 house. And all these kids are messaging me saying, like, I can't go to school because all the teachers have had to look at this photo. And I'm terrified.
God.
What that does to your perception of your body, of the people who are meant to protect you in your life, of men, of your view of yourself. So it just blew up, and basically it was like, oh, this isn't about me. This isn't about my instance. I've told a story here, and thousands of people are dealing with this every single day, and no one's talking about it. And it's happening more and more because of phones, and it's growing and it's growing. And then people are sending the imagery, and it's on porn sites, and they don't know. And we're not talking about it. So then the campaign just became where I was in my politics then, where I was in my feminism then. I was a white feminist then. The logical next mental step for me was, this is the system. That's where it ends, right? Because I hadn't looked into abolition politics or anything by that point. It was just, oh, this is the roof. The roof is the judicial system, the police, the legal system, and there's nothing past that. You can't create it.
Yeah.
So here's the system. How do I make a change to that system that will deter people from doing something and bring people justice? And so the mental step was, upskirting should be a sexual offence.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sitting here saying, I wish I hadn't done that. But what I am saying is that in the politics I'm in now, I may have gone for less punitive measures and more community-based prevention.
Yeah, I hear you.
Where I'm at now.
Yeah, I hear you. And holding that in mind, it also potentially, you know, it needed to happen. It needed to happen. And sometimes we have to have steps that happen first before we can do what it is that we actually need or desire, or is going to have a wider. Because I think what I really want to share today is that in doing all of your campaigning and all of the everything you had to endure to do that, and getting upskirting made illegal, there was something very, very important that I want to note about this. The fact that they're now able to track, what's the word? Now we're to track earlier on where people are engaging in upskirting, who ended up turning out or would have ended up doing acts of paedophilia or something greater than.
This allows us to recognise where on the spectrum people are in terms of what boundaries they're pushing.
Yeah.
And that was so important to me in the campaign, because we look at everything singularly, right?
Yes.
You know, we do this with everything. We say, oh, racism in football is a problem. Racism in the police is a problem. Well, then racism is a problem. We've got a problem with racism in society. Do you want to look at that? Or are you just going to compartmentalize it to different industries first, you know? And so we see that as a problem. So everyone I'm working with is, okay, upskirting is a problem, but it's not the worst problem. We need to focus on these things. Not understanding that we have to look at a continuum of violence to understand why the worst case scenario happens.
Exactly.
This is all structural. This is a continuum. You know, all of these human rights issues are deeply, intimately connected. You can't really talk about one without talking about the other.
Yes.
And I couldn't even get people to go from upskirting as a part of a continuum of assault. I couldn't even get them there.
Yeah.
And what was happening was, when I was being touched, it's not that bad. I spent literally 6 months basically convincing people in Parliament that it was different to being in the background of a picture in someone's phone.
Wow.
The kind of lack of understanding of being able to connect dots with these things is so worrying, especially when it's people in power and people in institutions.
Yeah.
And I had to get people to understand that these people who are committing this, majority men, are not only committing this act.
Yes.
They're doing other things because they're pushing, this is about power and consent, and they're pushing boundaries and they're seeing what they get away with, and then they graduate.
Yeah.
Effectively. And when the law came into force in April 2019, the two first men that we prosecuted, one was seen photographing a child, a girl, up her skirt around a supermarket. And when they took him in, he had 250,000 photos of children and decent children on his phone. The second guy was a convicted paedophile. He'd already been charged for making paedophilic material.
Mm.
And so what we're seeing is we're seeing a gateway behavior, effectively. And so when we start to look at these issues or look at behaviors in any way in conversations on social justice or conversations on human rights, you're seeing one part of a very big picture.
Mm.
And I think the reason the law works so well is because it was created with that concept in mind. It wasn't created as a siloed, like, this is a thing and then someone does it and they never do it again, or it's a joke, like it was with me. It was because I'd experienced it, the context was there.
Yes.
And that's something I am proud of, is that we managed to create, someone who experienced it created the law. So the law works better than it would have if it was, you know, a backbench conservative MP who's, you know, a 60-year-old white man. Like, it just been the same law and it wouldn't have worked as well.
But that's the issue. And I won't go into it today. I do go into it more into my book, but there's some stuff where I'm dissecting where racism is still embedded in the law, and parts of the reasons why some of the law that's supposed to protect people in marginalized identities from discrimination fundamentally don't work, because either they want to design it so that people don't actually are not actually able to access the support that they need, or it's the people who are designing the law have not got the lived experience of how they are compounded by discrimination, and it generally means that it's not fit for purpose.
100%. I mean, that the Race in Britain report shows you can't, it's like, it doesn't work. It's not going to work in the real world. People aren't going to be able to access that. And you're absolutely right. And there's so much of that. And it's terrifying because it's most of it.
Yeah. And that's the problem, because again, you know, who has made the law? Who is in positions of power? Who is in these decision-making roles? So it's why, you know, it's why I talk a lot to the individual change maker, and why we both talk to the individual change maker in our work, because I think people feel like there's got to be this, you know, particularly in anti-racism, another giant like Malcolm X or Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and these figures who are placed on pedestals, majority men, interestingly enough, but these figures that are placed on pedestals who elicit change. But actually, there is so much we can do individually that can help towards that. But a lot of it is around, well, education and awareness, and also confidence that our voices are powerful, especially when they're collective.
Yeah, I think that's the thing I've really learned this year, because I've been in a super uncomfortable period of reflection about my work and like where I am now. And it's because it's the only time I've ever been able to stop the law change in 2019. And I was...
Of course.
I was pulled 100 different ways by 100 different people, many of which only had commercial
endeavors. Interest.
Yeah. And I'm a very, very palatable commercial looking activist. You know, I'm a fashionable, light color, conventionally attractive, thin, white, young girl. And so you want to put me on the front of newspapers and put me in front of brands. And the commodification of activism fits very well with me.
Mm.
And so I was pulled in that direction for 10 months after the law change. And then I had a very uncomfortable crash because I suddenly saw how I was being held versus who I am, held up versus who I am. And my realization has been that if you looked at a newspaper article about me or a feature about me, you would go, oh, she did all that on her own. Oh, she, you know, she woke up, put a pink suit on, she walked to Parliament, she said, I'm gonna just deconstruct the patriarchy, girl boss, and then she did it, you know? And I didn't, like, it was 7-year-old girls and my lawyer, and it was law students, and it was organizers helping me print stuff for events, and it was lots of different people, non-binary people, girls, women telling me their stories. It was photographers, it was everyone together, but you don't see that because that's not glamorous.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how many times I mention all those people in an interview, they're not going to print that bit.
Yeah, they don't. They edit that out because it's not the narrative that they want to push.
They want the story of the David and Goliath, the young girl who took on the system and won. They want the glamour. And so I've had to stop giving people stuff because I can't trust how I'm going to be represented. And I'm not represented as an organizer or a campaigner. I'm represented as an influencer who, were you there when they changed the law? It's like, are you joking? I was like, I was in Parliament. Yeah. I was like, I did it all.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah, I'm hearing you. And for me, there's this dance between, because I mean, clearly, with your story and your what happened to you and how you use social media to get attention, leverage, awareness, there is, I always do this tango with social media and my relationship to it, because clearly there is a power in it. We can use social media in a way that influences change or raises awareness in a way that mainstream media doesn't, because it's so sanitized. You just get to hear different voices, and you know, you just get access to more information. But I also think that there is a risk of people just sanitizing what it takes to do activism campaigning. It sanitizes it. It makes it look very pretty. It makes it look like it's like you just there is. It's an aesthetic. It's what you place there, and it's that, you know, you manipulate essentially what the story is that you want people to see or how you're presented. It's like there is so much that goes on behind the scenes, and there is so much work that has to happen offline. I just worry, particularly now in the era that we're in, that it glamorizes things, and it can also cause harm, because I also think that people are very reactive on social media and they will just share things without research, without taking time and care. So I'm in a tango with how I feel about social media and activism.
You know, it's interesting that to hear you talk about it, because we both have large platforms now. I found it so much harder to do my activism with a large platform.
Same.
Because you had like a small group of concentrated, committed people who were there for the whole story. And when you asked for actions, they would sign this petition, do this thing, like we need to email your MP, but they would do it. And now it's like there's thousands of people in my house and they won't stop screaming, they keep breaking things, and I can't control anyone. And also, I'm too visible, because when I was smaller, it was, where are all these people coming from? All these people emailing us, or the, you know, parliamentarians were going, why is there some influx of all these young people? They were coming from me, but they didn't know me then. Mm. Now I'm so visible, they probably keep checks on me. What's Gina doing? What's she talking about? It's very hard. Yeah. You're a bit like a spy when you're an activist, because you have to come without people knowing that you're coming sometimes.
Yes.
I find it becomes harder to do that the more visible I am.
Yeah. So interesting that you say that. I've been recoiling. So I'm online. I am on Instagram a lot less. For many reasons, mostly to look after my mental health, if I'm honest, because that what I'm learning is there's this, and it's layered with my I'm a black woman, I'm also a dark-skinned black woman, and anti-blackness is rife. And whenever there is a human rights crisis in the world, I get people projectile vomiting in my inbox. And why aren't you talking about this? Why aren't you talking about that? We talked about Black Lives Matter. Why aren't you doing this? So there's that layer, which is rooted in white supremacy and anti-blackness. Like, I can tell the difference. And then there's also, like, in order to do the work well, again, they're only seeing the snippets that we share on social media. They forget that we're human beings as well.
Yeah.
There's other things going on in our lives anyway. being well, being unwell, illness, bereavement, whatever else is going on. Mm-hmm. But also for me to be able to do the work in my most powerful and in my integrity, I have to hold firm boundaries. And yeah. and that means that I do not talk about every single issue. And that's hard for some people who are only there for part of the story or are there to knock you off your pedestal. Let's be honest.
Let's be honest. Yeah.
That goes on as well. They're waiting for you to slip up. So, but that energy, if I'm not careful, it distracts me from doing my work.
Yes, 100%.
Because then I worry.
Yeah, it does. I can imagine that it really distracts you because that's the nature. I mean, it's Toni Morrison, isn't it? That's the nature of racism.
Well, there's that, yeah.
You put Toni your Morrison. Energy into these DMs and you put your energy into this, and every hour you do that, it exhausts you, so that the work that is so intentional and so important to you, you're so exhausted when you get to it.
Yeah. So either it doesn't get done or it doesn't get done in it doesn't get your full energy. Yeah. Which compromises the work.
Exactly. And that's the real, I think that's the thing that social media feels to me now. It used to feel like an exciting tool to organize in the early days for me. And now it's just more and more feeling like an energy drain, more and more feeling like a distraction. It's more and more feeling like I'm not good. The more time I spend on it, the worse I am at my work almost.
Yeah.
It has to be a tool I use. The work's over here and I'm doing the work and I'm doing it at my full capacity because I'm not engaging with the things that are distracting my energy and draining my energy.
Yes.
And then I'll take that work over to here and I'll offer it when I feel ready, when it feels done, when I feel, not when people are asking for it, not when people demand.
Yeah.
Because there's just on a logical level, like, letting 95,000 people dictate your timeline and your energy, it's just inhuman. It's just impossible.
It's totally impossible. And you're right. It's inhuman. It's anti-human. And it's treating you as a commodity rather than a human being, which is the very systems that we're trying to dismantle, particularly in anti-racism. But it was something you said to me earlier, Gina, where we were dialoguing before we hit record about you started to notice the nuances between campaigners stroke activists like you, who are white and more palatable in terms of mainstream, being held to a different standard than campaigners stroke activists who are particularly black women. Can you share more about that?
Yes, I feel, and I see this dynamic in the conversation of sexism as well. And that's where I first noticed it. And that's where it opened my eyes to what happens with me and my peers who are black women, and especially dark-skinned black women. So there's a lower bar for me in these conversations. As a white, thin woman, cishet woman in the world, I'm not expected to talk about these things. You don't expect me to talk about these things. And let's not tap into that because that's a whole other hour of conversation.
Yeah.
But there's a lower bar. So when something's happening in the world and there's a dialogue around it, I'm not demanded half, people don't demand from me half as much as they demand from Aja Barber or one of my other friends. I think because the bar's so low, the bar is we don't expect it from a white woman. And so we're not going to ask for it. But then also I feel like I'm afforded a level of humanity that my friends who are black activists don't get.
Yeah.
There's a take, as we talked about whiteness being a taking, there's a taking and a taking and a taking from Aja and from my other friends that is like a level I don't experience. And it's almost, it feels as if people almost think I deserve rest and time in a way they don't think Aja does, in a way they don't think my friends do. Like I don't, she's almost treated like I'm referencing Aja because we talk about it a lot and I haven't actually had deep discussions with other friends, but I've seen them post about it in this way. But she's treated as a resource. She's treated as people come five times harder for her to talk on things than me. And it's also this, it feels like an expectation of like, there's an element of manipulation in it because it's normally from white people and it's normally like, it's like everything's a tit for tat. It's like any engagement that they've had with anti-racism is like, well, that was a favor.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just humanity, like instead of like, well, it's the right thing to do. It was like, well, I did that. And it's like, And that was your choice. And you should have done that because it was the right thing to do, not so you could circle back later and use it as a reason to dehumanize black women in their DMs.
Yeah.
Like it's very...
It's racist. The very, very nature racist. Of setting a condition. And I write about this in my book, so you can have this snippet for free. Maybe for free, friends. The very function of making your anti-racism conditional is racist in itself.
Yes.
Like it,
using self-serving.
Self-serving, using it as a reason to justify anti-blackness, well, we did this and now you're not doing that. Now, you know, it is a very apparent and very ugly behaviour.
It is. And you see this dynamic. This is, as I said before, that's where I recognised it with men in the sexism conversation. If a man talks about male violence is praised beyond belief because we are desperate for a sorry man. We're desperate for a man who says, I know that this is happening. I understand in any capacity because we don't get it.
Yeah.
So when he does, oh my God. But we expect every woman to talk on it all the time. Every female activist and every non-binary activist and every or femme activist, why aren't you talking about every single issue that cis men are doing all over the world? So that's when I first saw it. And it's just the same dynamic, but with race and 100 times harder because it's racism.
Yeah, it's that energy that's going towards the people who are living with, who are most compounded by living with discrimination, especially those of us whose identities intersect with more than one marginalised group. But yet, where's the energy for you know, put that energy in a cis white man's inbox, or put that energy towards a government or something. It's very interesting that energy is targeted towards the people who are most impacted by systems of discrimination.
Yeah, I talked about this in my TED talk. Is like we always leave the people who are experiencing it to solve it, and that's what, it will never end then, because the people who created the system and who benefit from every day aren't engaged in solving it.
Yeah.
They're the ones who have the access. And it's also so exhausting. It's so unfair. It's just another way to feel exhausted.
Yeah.
Every single day. And
you know, we can't do the important work that we need to do in the world when we're exhausted. So that's another reason why, you know, the boundaries and the self-care are really, really important, because it just means we can show up in the world and for ourselves and the people that we're in relationship with as, you know, full functioning human beings and not one who are dragging ourselves through because we've been depleted. So, yeah.
As we deserve.
As we deserve. As we deserve, with full chest. So as we come to an end, which I don't want to do, but I know we have to. There's one thing that, I mean, your TED talk, and I will link to this in the show notes, your TED talk, I mean, Gina got a blubbering WhatsApp. I could not speak. I was, I mean, you know, Gina, I'm like, I don't know what's wrong with me. But it was just, because it encompassed so many experience, like so many of us who would be able to resonate with the message of experiencing some sort of sexual violence by a man or sexual assault by a man, just swallowing it, just not saying anything. And so many of us can relate to that, particularly with, you know, Tarana Burke's Me Too movement. But it was, I still can't articulate what it was that took my breath away about it, but it was just so moving. And there was something that you said in there that really stuck with me about how one of the most disarming phrases that you get in your work is, and you know what it is, but not all men.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I just applied that to, but not all white people, because it's the same thing for me. Can you just speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Not all men was the number one phrase that I received. Not always worded that way. But the intention and the meaning came up all the time. And I began to recognize it as like the best, and by best, I mean the most effective way of distracting from the problem to focus on men, to centralize men again. But also I was astounded by almost the stupidity of it, because I used to say to people like, imagine you're doing your taxes and you're like, I don't know, someone's stolen loads of money from me. Yeah, but not all people steal money. You'd be like, that's a weird thing to say. We're talking about the people that do right now.
Yeah.
And I was also upset by the fact that it really moved us away from the entire point, which is that, no, not all men do, but too many of them do.
Yeah.
Enough do that we have a problem.
Exactly.
Exactly the same with the not all white people. And it's fascinating how white women say not all men all the time, and then they do not understand what you mean when they basically say not all white people.
Yeah.
They do with their actions or with their body. Yeah. Even if they don't say it, they say, you know, why are you saying that as if, you know, this is a real, like, all of us do this, or why are you saying that as if, and it's, they're the ones saying not all men. They're the ones that are arguing against not all men, sorry.
Yeah.
But it's just the most common phrase, and it's just this real defense, the first card drawn, because to criticize a dominant community about the behavior by a majority just elicits this ultimate defense wall. And I feel like white cis het men, there isn't even an experience of structural oppression in their lives, and so they cannot get past the idea that they have to understand ours. And so, you know, the concept to most cis het men, I've talked to men about it, and the concept that, you know, racism and feminism are intimately interlinked and effectively the same thing, like, beyond, like, comprehension. It's like, what do you mean? But it's women and it's black people. And it's like, yeah, and black women exist. Like, they just don't, you know what I mean? But I had to do this piece in the TED Talk about not all men, because I just had to tell people, no, it's not. No one's saying it is, but it's too many and it's happening too much and we have a problem. And every time you say that, you are telling women and non-binary people and survivors that they're exaggerating, and they're not exaggerating. Yeah. Listen to us. And every single time I do it, I pair it with, or I say it in a speech, I pair it with the abuse I get. I show people the abuse I get, and I usually ask them to read it as if it's to their daughter or their friend. Because we also dehumanize those people and we say they're trolls. Yep. They're not trolls.
They're fathers, their lawyers, their managers, their parents, their grandparents, politicians, your mates.
Yeah, and that, I think, humanizing those people, showing that they're people, they're not bots.
Yeah.
And getting us to understand the fact that it doesn't have to be every man to do something about it. It just has to be enough that it's affecting every woman.
Yeah.
And so I did that in the TED Talk, that piece, and I cried so much. And I cry every time because I'm just so frustrated. I'm so frustrated I have to keep talking about it. I'm so exhausted. I'm so scared of men I don't know. I'm so, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that piece hit a lot of people because that section of it went really viral. And I think that's because we've heard that phrase so much. It's so normalized and we don't know how to take it on because it almost flummoxes you to the point where you can't even come back to it because you're like, yeah, but that's not the point. You don't know what to say back to it.
It's disarming because it's true. It's the truth. It's
factual. Yeah.
But it's, you know, I'm going to quote Toni Morrison in full. The very function of racism is distraction. It distracts us from what it is that we're actually talking about and trying to address. And actually, if people are interested in tackling the issue at hand, they wouldn't be saying that, because what that communicates to me is that they feel implicated.
Yeah, they feel complicit, so they're defending.
They're taking it on as a personal attack on their identity.
Yeah.
And that to me is just like that the ego is huge, man. Just move the
move
the ego out of the way so we could do the work. So that's what that's communicating with me. But in the moment, it's very, very disarming. So now that's one in my little pocket.
Oh yeah, I'm glad. If there's anything you can take from that, I'm really glad.
Yeah, I mean, there was loads, but thank you for sharing more about that. So to wrap up, how do we a nice thing I can give to listeners. So for listeners who don't, like, whether you like it or not, Gina, you're a role model. and clearly your approach to how you campaign and how you advocate for human rights has become potentially more intersectional than it was in the beginning.
Yeah.
So what words would you say to encourage people who feel like they're just a little old person who's got no impact and no influence in the world? How can you what words of encouragement can you give to the everyday person who doesn't think that their voice or who they are in the world matters, and how that they can impact change in the world around them? It's a big question.
It is a big question, but I think there's a few maybe practical ways to approach it that feel doable. The first thing I would say is, the moment you think you can't do anything or change something or your voice doesn't matter, they've won.
Yeah.
That's their entire intention. And by them, I mean the system and the institutions that are meant to be there for us. They want you to feel like you can't do anything, because then it stays the same.
Yeah.
So if you let them have that, they've already won. Secondly, I'd say that you don't arrive at being an activist. You just care about something and you can't not do something about it. And that doesn't have to be a law change. That can be something very small in your workplace. It can be in your household, how you raise your children. It can be in your community. That's the beautiful thing about activism, is that it's every size, every shape, every person in different ways.
Yeah.
But I would say, and I say this a lot because as a white woman, I have a very white audience, which, you know, your audience, and I don't know if that's the case here, but it has to come from you. It has to come from your experience, your life, something you know, because there's a lot of people pointing at things and going, I'm going to do that. And it's not their story to tell.
Yeah.
So something from your belly, something from inside, something that you feel, because then you don't run out of energy on it. Then you can't run out of energy because it means too much. It's from inside you. So think about the things you're angry. Use the anger. Anger's wonderful. anger's important. Shit. Oh, can I swear? Sorry.
You can swear. There's plenty of swearing in this podcast.
Good. The anger's really important shit. And they'll have you think it's not, because it's, again, it's better for them if you think it's not. But if you're angry about something, learn about it. Find other people that care about it. It's, this work is about other people. Connect with them. Share ideas. Build literacy about those problems, because we feel the things, but we can't articulate them. And the power is how we articulate them and we talk about them and we make people believe them. And so find other people, go for something that's your story. And just remember that every time you think, oh, I can't do that thing, or I can't say this, you can't use your voice, they've already won, because you can. It's the only thing that's actually ever changed things is regular people using their voices.
Powerful. Powerful, powerful, powerful. Gina, thank you so much. Can you let my listeners know where they can find you and support your work?
Yes. Oh, how nice. Yeah, I'm on Instagram at Gina Martin. I have a newsletter called The Good Chat on Substack. And the paperback of my activist toolkit, which is a very practical guide to organising, is out on June 3rd. So that would be lovely if you supported me by buying my book.
And she's forgotten to tell you what it's called. It's called Be the Change.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, that's always a good thing.
So the paperback is out on June the 3rd. So yeah, by the time this goes out, that will be out ready for you to gobble up and find out how you can use your self-agency to role model change. And one thing I will say is, you know, because you just do it naturally, Gina, and I think it's important to share that this is about humanity. Yes. And caring about people. And I don't think, yes, there's going to be more, you're going to be able to empathize easier if it is an experience that resonates with your own. But when you're starting to advocate for people in identities that are different to your own, the thing that combines and joins us all together is that it's our humanity. And I think that's a beautiful thing to do. And you just do that naturally, Gina. And it's clearly come from the fact that you love people. It's evident in your work.
I do. I love people and love the world. And if that's not where this comes from, then you're not doing it right.
Exactly. Gina Martin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure.
And there you have it, in conversation with campaigner and writer Gina Martin. And I hope you have gained useful knowledge and insight into the important role we each have as individuals and how powerful we are when we are a collective in making change in the world. The conversation with Gina really has solidified how there really isn't an excuse not to know where to start anymore in your advocacy. In not knowing what to say, in not knowing what to do. There's no excuse anymore. There are so many resources out there. Gina's book, Be the Change, being one of them, that can help us get started. that can help us learn how to be intentional with our advocacy, with our activism, so that it is meaningful and has impact and isn't just this scattergun approach of doing things to be seen to be doing them, but doing them because you care about making change in the world. Of course, one of those resources is The Good Ally, which is out in September 2021. It may even be out by the time you're listening to it, but that takes you on a hugely transformational and intentional and action-driven journey. And for those of you who want to take a deeper dive with your anti-racism, of course, my online course, Becoming Anti-Racist with Nova Reed, is ready and available to you. It's been consistently described as life-changing, and people are using the tools and the work within that through the self-interrogation to help them make change, not just in anti-racism, but in the world around them, in their relationships, in how they show up, in their communities, at work. Change is possible, and it's within each and every one of us. We just have to have the courage to start. So that's it from me. You know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you, please hop on over to your favourite podcast host and leave us a review. It means the world to me. Thank you again for choosing to share this corner of the internet with me. Until next time, take care of you.